If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Thursday, April the 18th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow. Our guest today in Hoover's recording studio on the campus of Stanford University is Leo Hanian. Leo Hanian is a Hoover Institution Senior Fellow and a Professor of Economics and Director of the Edinger Family Program in Macroeconomic Research at UCLA. He's also Associate Director of the Center for the Advanced Study in Economic Efficiency at Arizona State University and a Research Associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, where he co-directs the research initiative Macroeconomics Across Time and Space. And Lee is up here at Hoover today to take part in our centennial series. Lee, you're on a panel with Terry Anderson, who's done this podcast, John Cogan, who's done this podcast, and I guess they couldn't find a fourth, so they resorted to George Shultz.
Right.
That's heavy hitters.
Yeah, it is. It should be a lot of fun.
So the title of that conversation is Century of Prosperity, Review of the Standard of Living 1919 to 2019. Don't give me the ending, but just what's your role in this, and what exactly do you want to say?
Yeah, so we're going to discuss how economic freedom and free markets have played a role in the remarkable advances in standard of living in the United States. So we've had about a six-fold increase in per capita income since the Hoover Institution was founded in 1919. We'll talk about the role good economic policies have played in enhancing growth, and we'll also talk about the role that poorly designed economic policies have played in occasionally getting the economy off the rails.
Speaking of which, socialism on the rise these days. Lee, is socialism on the rise mean that the free market is on the decline as far as Americans are concerned?
It is on the rise, and I think it's on the rise for the wrong reasons. What I mean by that is those who are proponents of socialism are really grossly misinformed about what it is and which countries have socialist policies. For example, Bernie Sanders has talked about Scandinavian socialism in Sweden and Denmark. Mm-hmm. Denmark and Sweden had socialist policies between 1960 and 1990, which they admit were disasters. In the last 25 years, they've had market reforms that would make Milton Friedman proud, of which Sanders is completely ignorant about. If Sanders knew what was up in Sweden and Denmark today, such as for-profit schools, school vouchers, remarkable deregulation, privatization of healthcare, a 20% corporate tax rate, he would be shocked, and he would absolutely be an opponent of those policies. So I think there's a lot of misinformation about socialism and what role it can play and how it is, I think, very deficient to the market process.
You're an economics professor. Is it possible for a kid to go through 4 years of college, get an economics education, but not really understand the awfulness of socialism? Because I look at someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She went to Boston University. She has a college degree. In theory, she should have had a conversation with a professor about this. But are America's universities basically failing on this front, not giving kids the big picture they need on economics?
Yeah, I think we are doing that. And I think, I'm a college professor, so I'm part of that cartel. So yes, we're not doing a good job on that. You know, there's this old saw, and it always gets my blood pressure up, which is you'll hear people oftentimes say, socialism is great in theory, but not so good in practice because we just haven't figured out how to implement it correctly. Mm-hmm. And the reason that raises my blood pressure is because, socialism fails because it's a lousy theory. It's not a good theory, and lousy theories fail when they're implemented. And it's a lousy theory because it just runs counter to basic human instincts, the instincts that we have to take care of ourselves and take care of our families, and we want to do that right, with as much freedom as we can. Socialism is totally the opposite of that, and I think that's why it inevitably fails every time it's implemented.
Right. Now, you and I are just not colleagues here at the Hoover Institution. We're also partners in crime, and each week we commit a crime of sorts. We write for a column, something which was your idea. It's called California On Your Mind. It's what we at Hoover call a web channel, a part of the Hoover website where you can go and find content. How did you come up with California on your mind? What was the genesis of doing
this?
Yeah,
well, first of all, let me just say it's been fun working with you on this, mm-hmm. And we're having, I think we're doing some really interesting stuff. You know, I mean, I'm a native Californian, and I lived outside the state for a number of years when I went to graduate school, and my first teaching jobs were outside California. Mm-hmm. And when I came back to California, I left in 1988, and I came back in 1999. The state that I left, I didn't really recognize anymore. Not just because traffic was always bad, but just the entrepreneurial spirit that I knew of California, the love of economic freedom and independence that I knew about California. These were aspects of California that didn't seem to be here anymore. And that was 20 years ago. And I would say, if anything, lack of economic freedom, lack of independence, a sense that government should have limitations over the lives of its citizens, those issues have gotten even worse. Right. And it pains me, as a native Californian, it pains me to see that happening to the state. So right. California on Your Mind was my idea, along with you, to try to address some of these issues on a biweekly basis.
Right. So there's an easy answer to explain a lot of the problems of modern California, and that's to say that you can't look at California through the romantic lens of 50 years ago. This is not Pat Brown's California, even though Son Jerry ran it twice in the 1970s and 80s, and again prior to Gavin Newsom taking the office this year. But the California that Pat Brown ran was what? About 15 million people, I think, Lee. And today, as a nation state of 40 million people with an economy that is on a global scale, California is what, the fifth largest economy,
yes,
I think, now, or
fifth
something
largest.
Like that? Right. And with that much size and that many people, would come a lot of headaches that Pat Brown maybe wouldn't understand these days.
It's a tougher job. It's a more complex job.
Right. Problem number one is obviously, Lee, incredible wealth, but also incredible poverty. And I don't think that poverty was there 50 years ago.
No. There is a sense 50 years ago, I think there's a sense 40 years ago and probably 30 years ago, that if you had an idea, mm-hmm. and you were willing to take risk, California was the place to be, because that was the best opportunity for you to make it. It was the place where everything grew, including good economic ideas. I don't think that's true anymore. So I think we're making it much more, despite the fact that California is a very big state, more complex state than it used to be, we're making it difficult for ourselves to succeed. Mm-hmm. We now have a government that spends, on inflation-adjusted per capita terms, about five times more per person than in the days of Pat Brown. Mm-hmm. California has, as you noted, just enormous disparity in economic outcomes.
Right.
There are people such as Mark Zuckerberg with a $70 billion net worth living in San Francisco. Which one of his three houses there he occupies, I don't know. And then we have families that are just absolutely miserably struggling in the Central Valley, mm-hmm. which hasn't yet recovered back to its pre-financial crisis economy. And I think the policies that are in place now are doing disservice, particularly those people in the Central Valley.
So one thing I look at, Lee, is it's often said California has a barbell economy, heavily weighted at the top with wealth and heavily weighted at the bottom with poverty. But we also, when you think about it, a barbell legislature, in that it's heavily weighted at the top with big, large, grandiose ideas, many of which just simply don't fly, but also weighted heavily at the bottom with just a lot of kind of nickel and dime, somewhat silly ideas. For example, the state of California is currently weighing whether or not to go to war with manufacturers of small bottles of shampoo. When you check into a hotel and you get a little tiny travel size thing of shampoo, this is bad for the environment, apparently, so California wants to ban these things. So it's these little tiny symbolic things, Lee, that I think kind of nip at the existence. But let's talk a minute about a couple of the big ideas, and one you just wrote about, which is the idea of implementing single-payer care in California.
Right.
This is a problem for Gavin Newsom. Why? Because he didn't want to kill the idea of single-payer care. He's tried to dance around it, saying that he supports universal care, right? But not the single-payer system, which was bandied about in the legislature, which Jerry Brown threw cold water on. What's going to happen there?
Yeah. Newsom is between a rock and a hard place, because
right.
he has campaigned on universal health care. Universal health care really means single-payer health care.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's different types of single-payer health care one might deliver. The one that's been discussed in California, which was, I believe, SB 562.
Yes.
Which, as you noted, Brown, thankfully, threw cold water on, would have been just disastrous, and would have been disastrous relative to the terrible outcomes we see in single-payer countries such as the UK. Mm-hmm. In Europe, so the column you referred to cites some statistics from the National Health Service in Europe, mm-hmm. and it is awful.
Right.
Doctors are ready to go on strike. Doctors talk about treating patients in medical battlefield type situations. Cancer patients in the UK, one out of four are not getting urgently recommended treatment on time. What does on time mean?
Mm-hmm.
Within 2 months. In the UK. Cancer survivorship rates are low in the UK relative to the US. So when we think about the idea that the most important expenditures we make on our own health and the health of our families, that choice could be completely taken away from us. It's a chilling thought. And I hope, I'm keeping my fingers crossed, that people will see this and will respond to it by saying, no, we want to have choice. We want to be able to make our own decisions in terms of who we purchase our health care from. But it's a concern. We'll see what Newsom does. He's
right. So the politics are interesting, Lee, because Jerry Brown was pretty good at controlling the legislature in this regard. He didn't like to have showdowns. And so when something like this would come up, and indeed when SB 562 came up the last time, what Brown said was, if somebody can show me how you can pay for it, then I'll listen to it. And of course, you can't find a way to pay for it, so that killed the conversation. It was Brown's way of saying, don't bother sending this to me. I will veto it, and you'll try to override it, and you'll fail, and none of us will be happy about this. So this is an interesting political wrinkle here, Lee. Whether or not the legislature goes down the same path with the same bill, Newsom's going to have to signal to them if he's interested in signing it or not, which means he's going to have to make a decision on it. And that gets to the other side of this. You know, there's the old saying, the cynic knows the value of nothing and the cost of everything. Well, the cost is the issue with single-payer care, in addition, obviously, the quality of the health care. How do you pay for it? My guess is the only way you pay for it is what? A big payroll tax.
Exactly. So independent estimates of SB 562 would have been as much as $400 billion per year.
Mm-hmm.
To put that in perspective, that's twice the current state budget.
Mm-hmm.
It works out to about a little over $10,000 per person in the state.
Mm-hmm.
Now, interestingly, so Brown said, you can't find a way to pay for this. Don't even think about it.
Right.
Newsom, on the other hand, hasn't talked so much about the cost, which he certainly is fully aware of.
Right.
But what Newsom has said is, well, what really stands between us and having single-payer universal health care is really we would have to get waivers from the federal government, and that's going to be somewhat of a challenge. He's not disputing this on the basis of cost or quality, rather that Trump's going to throw up some roadblocks for us. So
right.
That's really what's giving him cover now. And that concerns me that he's not considering the fiscal realities or the quality issues.
So you wrote a column about Newsom's first 100 days for Hoover, and I wrote a column about his first 100 days for World Clear Politics. So tell me what you saw, and I'll tell you what I saw. So give me your thoughts on Gavin Newsom, 100 days in.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. So a few months ago, I and some other Hoover folks wrote a policy paper called Economic Challenges Facing California's Next Governor. And in the context of this, I contacted both the John Cox campaign and the Newsom campaign to see if they wanted to say more about other than what was on their website.
Right.
And I never really got past the firewall at the Newsom campaign, but my email address was put on Newsom's mailing list. So I now receive weekly requests from Governor Newsom asking for campaign contributions. But in terms of those first 100 days, I'm disappointed from the perspective that we have these upfront near face issues that just have to be dealt with. You mentioned the enormous economic disparity in the state, part of which is related to housing cost issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so the governor has addressed that by essentially suing or threatening to sue cities for not building as much housing as the state housing board thinks they should be building.
Right.
And some of this really kind of putting the cart before the horse. We have enormously high building costs in the state. Right now, to build a two-bedroom apartment that would be considered affordable costs about $450,000 to construct. Mm-hmm. People in other states just look at that number. $450,000 to build a two-bedroom apartment, that's just completely nuts.
Right.
That's really what needs to be dealt with rather than suing cities for not implementing housing programs. The other thing he's been very, very proud of is really taking on Donald Trump, particularly with respect to the issue of immigration. Mm-hmm. And we both have written about Governor Newsom's recent trip to El Salvador. And I titled my column, "Is California's President Already Running for the 2024 Presidential Election?" Because I couldn't really figure out a reason. Right.
A Republican lawmayor in Sacramento had a pretty good rejoinder to Newsom, saying, "If you really want to see third world conditions, I'll be glad to show you the Central Valley."
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Absolutely right.
Right. Yeah, so that's a pretty good take on Newsom. So let me give you a few of my thoughts here. So the next California in Your Mind column that I'm working on, Lee, in fact, I'm writing it already because I'm out of town for a few days. I'm writing about fracking, and here's why. Earth Day is on Monday. And I wholly expect, I would not be shocked if Newsom declared a moratorium, a ban on fracking in California on Earth Day. Why? It's a very kind of Gavin thing to do. This is the guy who 66 days into his governorship declared a moratorium on the death penalty. He loves to do executive action, things like that, that are very showy. And this is one of the tells of his administration so far. He loves big pronouncements, big events, even if they don't add up that much. The moratorium on the death penalty is a good example. Got a lot of headlines for this, but good Lord, there are a handful of states that have already done this decade, so it's not like California is leading the way. Fracking would be the same way, Lee. Andrew Cuomo put the kibosh on fracking in New York, I think, in December of 2014. The Oregon State House Representatives just voted it down last month, so we're not leading the way, but he loves that dramatic moment. The second defining thing of Gavin Newsom so far is he wants to be the un-Jerry. And so doing fracking, which Jerry Brown had a really kind of complicated relationship with because he wanted to be an environmentalist, but Jerry Brown at all times was also thinking jobs and employment. He didn't want to screw up Kern County, California, places like that that are very oil dependent. But Newsom was 29 years younger than Jerry Brown and has a full head of hair, whereas Jerry doesn't and just wants to be seen as more vigorous, almost like Kennedy to Eisenhower, if you will. He wants to do splashy things. And then the third defining thing is, you're right, it's whatever he can do to piss off Donald Trump. And if he does fracking, Trump will come back with him pushing on oil and so forth. So, but the thing with Newsom is he can keep doing this, Lee, for 4 years. And he'll get reelected probably because California is pretty much a slam dunk for Democrats now. But the clock is ticking in this regard. That's the economy. Let's talk about economics for a second. California goes boom and bust all the time. And each May, when Jerry Brown would come out in his second term and do his budget announcement, he would say that, you know what, we can't spend like we'd like to, like you guys want to, because guess what? We're headed for a recession. Trust me, it's coming. But it's not here yet. But as an economist, you look at the California economy. Let me ask you it in these terms, as a former speechwriter. Every year, the President of the United States gets up in State of the Union address and says, ladies and gentlemen, the State of the Union is strong. If you had to do the same with the California economy, what adjective would you describe? Strong or not?
Yeah. It would be a schizophrenic economy.
How so?
In which coastal California, some people in coastal California, meaning the counties that border the ocean or within roughly 20 miles of the ocean, mm-hmm. those people are doing really quite well.
Right.
In terms of income growth, in terms of income levels, mm-hmm. Then you have people living in Fresno and Bakersfield and Merced and Madera and Stockton,
right.
Whose incomes are really very, very low. So there's really, it's really kind of a tale of two Californias. You're absolutely right. Newsom loves the big political splash. What you mentioned about Earth Day is interesting because obviously environmental issues here in California, he's going to get enormous amount of kudos for that.
And he's already getting grief from the environmental crowd of not doing enough in his first 100 days. So it seemed kind of the Gavin thing to do. But this is April, and as I like to say, mid-April causes antacids for unrest for California governors. Why? Not because they're worried about paying their taxes, because they're worried, Lee, about how much money is coming in the form of revenue. And this is what's fascinating about California right now. we have an economy that is producing a lot of money right now, and that money is seen going into Sacramento and creating a large surplus. The state budget is now up to $209 billion. That's what Newsom proposed in January, $209 billion. Lee, when I came into work for Pete Wilson when he was governor in the 1990s, let's see, Wilson inherited a budget that was about $40 billion, I think. I think when he left office, it was up around 70 or 80. Yeah. So now we're over $200 billion. But you look at the California economy in April, Lee, and what do you see? Jerry Brown's first year in office, about 53% of the revenue in the state was dependent upon personal income. It's now up to 70%.
Yes.
And this creates some staggering numbers. The state of California is expecting $20 billion in revenue on April 15th. The day after April 15th, it was expecting another $3 billion, Lee. That translates to $2 million a minute that has to come into Sacramento. So you could say on the one hand, well, California is minting money. We're having IPOs and people are making money in the stock market and selling houses. Times are good. On the other hand, my God, this is sort of like balancing plates on top of sticks. And sure. How long can you keep them all spinning?
Sure, sure. California is in a precarious position with state finances, largely because so much of the revenue is dependent on income taxes.
Right.
And not only that, so much is dependent upon the top 1% and 5%. So California is the only state in the country in which the top 1% of earners provide over 50% of state revenue. State income tax revenue.
Right.
And what's, and you know, just moving aside from whether people think that's fair or people think that's wise, that revenue source is very volatile.
Right.
So it's dependent upon capital gains realization. You mentioned IPOs. So Brown was right in terms of building up a rainy day fund for California. But that can go very, very quickly.
It goes very quickly. So the rainy day fund, Lee, I think is right now about $15 billion.
Yep.
If Michael Boskin, our colleague, or John Cogan were down here, they'd tell you that in a recession in California, the state's probably going to lose $60 billion.
Yep.
So that rainy day fund, it's sort of like a Category 1 cottage built for a Category 4 storm.
Yes.
So not going to last very long.
No, it's not going to last very long.
Right. So Brown made a big deal out of building up a rainy day fund. Good for him because that money would have been spent. On the other hand, one thing he did not get into, Lee, was addressing the revenue system and tax reform. I happened to work for the last California governor who went after this, and that was 20 years ago, over 20 years ago. Mike Boskin and John Cogan worked on the Commission on the 21st Century Economy, the so-called Parsky Commission. They produced a report. It'll be 10 years this fall. That report got a two-word response from the legislature, and those two words were Merry Christmas. It went right into the trash can. So if you were to go after the California economy, Lee, and look at ways to address the tax revenue system to produce a more reliable stream, what sort of things would you be looking at?
Yeah, I think there's really two issues there. One is having a relatively low volatility revenue stream, and the other is having a revenue stream that's capable of funding a reasonable level of government expenditures.
Mm-hmm.
So California is near the top in terms of spending per person. And a lot of that is really concentrated in healthcare and Medi-Cal.
Right.
So I would say tax reform should probably be accompanied by healthcare reform. In terms of tax reform, you know, the most reliable and low volatility revenue streams come from consumption taxes. Now, Newsom knows this, and Newsom has also suggested, maybe not so loudly, that he would like to start taxing services in the state. And that, all things equal, would be a better idea than trying to heavily tax income. The problem is, as you noted, California is a remarkable economic engine, and there is politicians like to look at that and say, there's a lot of revenue out there if we could just get at it.
Right.
Consumption taxes would allow them to get at that.
Mm-hmm.
What worries me is that that would simply just be feeding the beast.
This
would be just a problem with Leviathan. So I think really there's three points. One is, and not that I'm necessarily optimistic about this, but having reasonable, sensible growth in state expenditures, financing those in a low volatility way, and really health care and Medi-Cal has got to be part of that conversation.
Right. Let me throw three proposed tax increases at you and let me get your thoughts. One is a run on the estate tax in California. And you would raise the estate tax to, I think, 40%, going up to the level at which the federal estate tax kicks in, which I think is 11 million individually and 22 for a couple. So that's a raid on wealth.
Yes.
Second is going after corporations that make at least $10 million a year. And this is under the guise of inequality between what CEOs get, what workers get. So you go after those companies. And then the third one, the Big Daddy Lee, which looks like we're going to have a fight over on the ballot in 2020. And that's revisiting Prop 13.
Right, right.
And the so-called split roll tax, which would readjust the commercial property taxes on California to current prices.
Sure.
Right. What happens if split roll goes through in California?
Yeah. There'll be some business exit. Mm-hmm. The revenue that will come in will not be probably nearly as much as was projected. Mm-hmm. There is a USC study done by, I believe, their policy school, which gave some pretty rosy pronouncements. Now, the problem with the USC pronouncements is that they built in literally no behavioral response to businesses in terms of whether this if this tax went through. So they assume no businesses left the state.
I assume everybody stays there and just pays.
Everybody
more.
Stays there. There's right. no decline in property values. There's no responses whatsoever. So of those three, as an economist, I just have to say I don't like any of them.
Right.
And again, this is not really politics. This is more like, you know, the solution, as a politician, the solution to getting revenue is not killing the golden goose.
Right.
So all of those tax proposals can kill the golden goose. Estate taxes lead people to leave the state.
Right.
Old people, elderly people often are ready to leave and go to different climes.
Right.
In any case, Prop 13 had should be addressed. Mm-hmm. It was in many ways a flawed bill. Although what's interesting is that 40 years later, politicians aren't really seeing, hey, people have been telling us for 40 years
right.
that we're taking too much from them.
Right.
I can't say that any of those three are on my list of if you wanted to raise taxes, how would you do without killing the golden goose? None of those would really do the trick.
But this is the mindset in Sacramento. They see California, especially the top 1%, as the monopoly man. And the idea is to pick up the monopoly man, turn him upside down, and shake the money
yep.
out of him.
Yep.
But it's just a perverse existence because you're just trying to take as much money out of the top 1% and praying like hell they don't leave. Because
yes.
if they leave, then the system collapses.
Yep, absolutely.
What would happen if they did a residential run on Prop 13?
That would be... That would be politically incredibly unpopular.
Besides the pitchfork rebellion and torch mobs
yeah,
in the state capitol.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Prop 13 needs to be addressed from the standpoint that there are some properties, both business and residential, in which property taxes are just amazingly low.
Sure.
Properties that haven't just turned over in many, many, many years. You know, we know what to do in terms of having a reasonable assessment of property tax in California. The problem is, I think voters, and for good reason, don't trust politicians. They don't
right.
They didn't trust politicians in the 1970s. It's worse today. So I think Sacramento is thinking, you know, if we can stick it to businesses with Prop 13, mm-hmm. you know, consumers, households, they're not going to see that there'll be a run, that
right.
businesses will leave. They'll be okay with this. And the smoke and mirrors approach to taxation is not good, certainly not good economics. I don't think it's good politics either.
Well, one thing would happen, Lee, is let's say we hopped in a car, went over to Palo Alto, Professorville or old Palo Alto. You'll find people living there to advanced ages. It's a nice place to live. Longevity is strong in this part of California. And people have been living in those houses for 20, 30 years, and their property value has probably gone up maybe tenfold over
sure.
that time. So now if you're taking somebody from paying taxes on a $300,000 house to a $3 million house, I think they probably have one option, Lee. That's to leave.
Yep. Yes.
Now, the way the real estate market works around here, the line will form at the rear of people who want to buy that house in Palo Alto, and they'll stay in it to a certain point, and they'll leave. But there is a cost here eventually, Lee, and the cost, I think, is middle-class California. If you want to come here and you don't make millions of dollars a year, let's say you make $100,000 a year, $200,000 a year. It's interesting. I've seen surveys of people who live in Palo Alto and they make $400,000 a year. They consider themselves middle class.
Sure.
But there is a certain threshold for actually having a quality of life in California. If quality of life is a house and a car and saving for college and so forth, what's going to happen to the middle class in here down the
yeah,
road?
Yeah, it is so hard. And Every month, I look at the California Association of Realtors reports mm-hmm. on the California housing market, and I look at the volume of sales and prices. And I just keep shaking my head and thinking, how can people afford, how can people who aren't independently wealthy or who don't have a lot of equity, how can they afford to live here? So I mentioned coastal California being relatively successful. Mm-hmm. The median household income, so potentially more than one earner, median household income in coastal California, including Silicon Valley, San Francisco, LA, San Diego County, right. $75,000. The median home price in coastal California, and we're not, you know, and some of my columns, I'll include a link to a Zillow showing a house, is $750,000, and that is not a palace.
Right.
And when you think about, okay, let's think about trying to finance a $750,000 house. How many people have $150,000 of cash to put in as a 20% down payment? How many people can afford $11,000 in property taxes? How many people can afford, off the top of my head, in terms of a mortgage, that's going to be something like $2,500 a month in mortgage fees?
Right.
To support that house, one has to have household income about $130,000.
Right. So I suggest you could maybe you could do the down payment. Let's say if you're lucky enough to have parents who have money to give you, you could do the down payment. And let's say you can make your monthly payment and your taxes if two people are working. Now the question is, can you save for college for your kids? You're living a life, Lee, where there's really no room for error. You can't take a year off if you want to and study cooking or just, you know, take a break from the rat race. Two people have to be working at all times. And even at best with that, you're just kind of bobbing above the surface.
You're hitting the nail on the head. To realistically have the life you're talking about in California.
Right.
One is a household income in these areas where housing is expensive of $160,000, $170,000 a year. And if you did a survey throughout the United States and said, is $160,000, $170,000, should people be scraping by on that? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, of course not. Well, here in California, they are.
Now, there is a place to find affordable housing, and that's the Central Valley.
Yeah.
But as far as I've seen, the only idea of development in the Central Valley is to put a fast train through a part of it.
Yeah.
So if you're Gavin Newsom, what do you do to develop the valley?
Well, you know, it's interesting. So Newsom came out regarding the bullet train, which was Brown's pet project. I don't know why he had that bug in his ear for all these years.
Well, so with Jerry Brown, it's easily explainable. Brown's lived to build. Pat built roads, Pat built schools, Pat built the water system. So it's in the Brown DNA to like construction. So Jerry was attracted to the construction, and Jerry Brown, just being a very stubborn person, dug in on it. And this gets to my point of Gavin being the young Jerry, because what's more on Jerry than standing up in front of the legislature and saying, the system doesn't work.
Yeah.
But what he managed to do is confuse the hell out of everybody, because he gave the impression that he wanted to stop it. So what he wants to do instead is he wants to build the opening line through part of the Central Valley and then see where we go from there. But it gets back to the question, Lee, if you really want to do economic growth in the Central Valley, I'm not sure that a fast train is going to do it on its own.
No. The fast train just from Bakersfield, I believe, to Merced.
Yes.
Would cost about $20 billion.
Right.
And just imagine the kind of economic development one could do in the Central Valley for $20 billion that was not allocated to putting wooden stakes in the ground.
Right.
One could do really, really some amazing things. But, you know, when we think about California and as California goes forward, I think there's no alternative than to say, growth will have to occur outside of coastal California. You look at the San Francisco population today is about the same it was in 50 years ago. We're not building more houses in California. We can build more houses in Stockton and Fresno, and, you know, you can buy a pretty nice house in Stockton and Fresno for about $250,000.
Exactly. Of course, this causes other headaches for the governor, one being, where do you build? And he made a decision the other day, at least he announced that he's okay with building in areas that are prone to wildfire. Two ways to look at this. Okay, good, there's space to build, let's build. On the other hand, there's a little kind of Einstein quality to this, which is what? The definition of insanity is what? Doing the same failed thing over and over again. So why are you going to build on the same sites that getting burned down by wildfires?
Sure. You know, it's interesting, where I live, near my home, there was a fire that moved from Ventura to Santa Barbara. And it went for about a week and a half. My wife and I just kept thinking, why can't this thing be stopped? Well, one reason it wasn't stopped is because no brush control, no backfires had been set for probably 20 years. So again, when we think about California, we think about the California budget, we think about budget priorities, we have all this money going to Medi-Cal. Mm-hmm. There's really no nickels and dimes left to do things like maintain brush areas, clean out debris channels. The number one job of government is to protect the citizens. California's just not doing that very well right now.
Yeah, plus the state has to be a little more common sense. So, you know, if you live in Montecito, if you live in Malibu, areas like this, the state's going to have to take a little more sensible look about where you're living and perhaps adjust your insurance for living in those areas or perhaps stop development in those.
Sure.
Let's close out with a topic. I want to be careful here because this affects UCLA and affects Stanford too, and that's the admissions scandal.
Yeah.
What says it about California in this age? How does it reflect on the state when you have this group of individuals, people with considerable resources, and they use their resources for the procurement of getting their kids into a college? It's easy to bust on the parents saying that, look, this is not parenting. This is just really about wanting to brag about your children. So my child who's just clearly not academically driven, I'm going to make sure that kid gets into UCLA or USC so I can brag to my fellow Angelenos that my child goes to USC. Bad parenting. You can argue that it's bad secondary education. These kids are going through very exclusive schools, and they appear to be pretty dim bulbs for all of that. But what does it say about our state and our culture right now that this goes on? I mean, in the California that you grew up in, Lee, do you think that there are parents in Los Angeles bribing their kids into college?
I think one of the amazing things Pat Brown did, and I think he did a number of really, really good things, was the master plan.
Right.
Both the UC system and the state college system and the community college system. And it worked just incredibly well for so many, many years. And I think what we're seeing now with the admissions scandal is particularly bad, say, for my institution, UCLA, because it's a public institution and there's a level of public trust there. And that public trust has been broken. Mm-hmm. And what came out last week is that with UCLA, it was just not what occurred very recently. There was some other cases that occurred back in 2014. And again, related to, we'll take your kid as a walk-on athlete, where admission standards are different, with a sufficiently sizable check. So I think it's very sad. Parents feel the need to do this. I actually wrote a California On Your Mind column about this.
Right.
And as a college professor for the last 27 years, what I advised in that column is parents really shouldn't worry about the prestige status of a school. Find a university or college for your kid that's a good fit, where they feel comfortable, they have a healthy peer group to interact with, they can get excited about. I think it's a very sad day for all of us when this happens.
I think the prestige thing has been going on in California for some time, Lee, but maybe not in the bribe sense that we've seen in the LA Times, but in this regard, thousands upon thousands of parents each year have their kids apply to the UC system. And then they get back a letter, and they find out their kid didn't get into Berkeley. Yeah. Their precious little Johnny or Mary didn't make Berkeley.
Right.
Why did Johnny not get into Berkeley, but he got to Santa Barbara? In other words, is my child not good enough to go to this school? So there is that kind of underboiling. No, it's funny. I've been here long enough, Lee, where the first flashpoint with education in California was when I worked for Wilson, and that was Proposition 209 and the idea of colorblind admissions.
Sure.
Because this, again, was a question of who was going to the UCs and who was represented. I think since then, the undercurrent's always been there, but it shifted more, I think, to a middle-class question of my kid getting to Berkeley. But I think this is the new wrinkle. It's the idea of the universities are being used now for status for these parents.
Oh, absolutely. You know, from a political perspective, you look back at the 2016 election, and Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders agreed on one thing. They said a little bit differently. Sanders talked about the rigged system and the rigged society. Mm-hmm. And Trump talked about the elites and cleaning out the swamp. And I think at some level, both are right. So what we have going on with universities is the elites in a rigged system really jumping up front and center. And when we talk about market forces and a market economy, elites are minimized in that kind of society. But what we've done with colleges, putting them up on this particular pedestal and status. We're sort of inviting that right now. And it, for me, it's very, very sad to see this.
Definitely is. Final question. The current controversy between Trump, Gavin Newsom, Democrats writ large on what to do with migrants and Trump's proposal, put them on buses, send them to sanctuary cities. I don't know if this happens or not. I will say this. It's a very clever political ploy by Trump in this regard. He puts these people in an uncomfortable position. What is a sanctuary city if it doesn't offer sanctuary to a migrant? Sure. And there's NIMBYism. I think you probably saw Cher was guilty of NIMBYism.
Sure.
It's
yeah.
just, ooh, do we really want this to happen where we live or not? So clever, I think, for Trump to put Democrats on the heels. But what would happen if this went into effect?
Yeah, I thought it was, yes, I agree, very clever political ploy. I wonder who came up with that. I'm not sure I'm not sure he did.
But take your Los Angeles, for example. Yeah. If you took 5,000 people, let's say, for just a number, threw them into Los Angeles, well, what's a Los Angeles area? 20 million people, something like that? No, that's, you know, that's a pimple. But on the other hand, that's 5,000 people in Los Angeles without what? Without work, without any kind of safety net. So does the city now inherit them? Does the state? How do they fit into the society?
Right. How do they fit into society? And it is a huge problem. Mm-hmm. Even if it's 5,000, and if it becomes 20 or 25,000, it becomes an enormous problem. Sadly, Californians have so many incumbent challenges. And irrespective of how people feel about how immigration laws should be reformed and whether undocumented immigrants should be rounded up. The simple issue is that too many people in California right now are leading lives that in which they're being incredibly challenged and they're living paycheck to paycheck. California is not a state in a position to be saying we're going to open our arms to everybody who wants to come here, because guess what? Everybody wants to come here.
Right. But that is Gavin Newsom's rhetoric.
And that's Gavin Newsom's rhetoric. And he's playing a dangerous game. And I think Trump put him into check with that last move. So we'll see what Newsom does. I'm not sure there's a particularly good next move for Newsom that won't cost him some political capital.
Could be. But you're staying in California for the interim.
I am here, yes. My wife is tough to move.
Okay, well, Leo Haney, enjoy the conversation. Good luck with the conversation with George Shultz. Tell him I said hi.
Bill, I will do that. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States, and in this case, the Golden State of California. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. That's where you'll find California on Your Mind. Leo Hanian's columns come out on Tuesdays. Usually. Mine come out on Thursday. You'll find one today I wrote on, of all things, Kevin Durant and LeBron James. While you're there at the Hoover website, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Leo Hanian and his Hoover colleagues to your inbox every weekday. And that certainly includes California on Your Mind. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is at Hoover Inst. That's at Hoover INST. Leo Hanian, brave man that he is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at Lee_Ohanian. Ohanian is spelled O-H-A-N-I-A-N. At Lee_Ohanian. And my Twitter handle is at Hoover Whalen. Whalen spelled W-H-A-L-E-N. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. As always, thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Podbean, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.